Well, hello again, podcast listeners, and welcome to episode 12 of Talk Sports, our adventures in the art of lively conversation. I'm your host, Gary Zabinski, and I'm joined, as always, by my double play combo partner, the sure-handed and fleet of foot, Roscoe. How's that for our first sports reference of the day, Roscoe?
I'm feeling lively and conversant, if not always fleet of foot.
No one turns the double play at the hot corner like you do. I'm sure you've been told that many times in your life, and that's gotten you in a lot of trouble. Well, oh my goodness, have we got a delightful show for you today. Roscoe and I recently attended a performance of the exceptional Looking Glass Theater show Moby Dick here in downtown Chicago. Why don't you tell them a little bit about that show that we saw?
Well, it's a spectacular show. It's gotten through the roof reviews, highly recommended from virtually every critic in Chicago. It's at Looking Glass Theater, which is at the pumping station across the street from Chicago's historic water tower.
These 821 are the, North Michigan.
Yes, these are the two buildings that are known for being, they were built long before the Chicago Fire, and that's where the Chicago Fire ended, right there. It is still a pumping station 150 years later. Yeah. And guess what? In the back of the pumping station, they found room to build a theater, which is now a world-class theater, internationally renowned Looking Glass Theater. They're doing a stage adaptation of Moby Dick by Herman Melville, which is sensational. And how do we describe this production? It is a traditional script play with incredible production values, lots of gymnastics and movement.
Very imaginative use of storytelling. Even though, yeah, there's a bit of a script. Sometimes it's a bit more scripted than other times. It's completely visual. They'll do an entire sequence just with flying acrobats or some aerialists or some unbelievably amazing costume bit that goes on for minutes and minutes and minutes and takes you through the story.
Right. Movement, sound, choreography to tell this story. Something we should say, that there were two little children there that you happen to know. And how old were those kids?
I think they're seven and eight, maybe.
I'm telling you, this is a production of Moby Dick, which is a novel I couldn't get through my junior year in college. These kids were, and it's a long show, it's more than 2.5 hours. These kids were thrilled by this production. This was a great introduction to the magic of theater for two little children.
That little girl was doing the hornpipe as we were walking out.
Was she? You know, and this is a Friday night. We're getting out of, the show starts at 7:30. We're getting out at 10:15. And these kids were wide-eyed over what they saw. And I said, did you follow all of it? And the little girl said, well, I got lost a couple of times, but it was pretty exciting.
Very exciting. Yeah. I mean, it really took you along through the really choice parts of the story, including the when they catch a whale and they take the blubber off. I won't even begin to reveal to you how that happens. It's not disgusting. It's actually astoundingly beautiful in its effect. Well, today we are delighted to have with us as our guest the choreographer of that piece, the lovely and talented Sylvia Hernandez de Stasi of the Actors Gymnasium right here in Evanston, Illinois. From where we record these podcasts. And Ms. Hernandez de Stasi will be joining us in just a little while. But first, we have a few items, as usual, of business that I'd like to address. First off, this is a recurring thing with me. You know, of course, and our past listeners do, that the one thing I'm afraid of is
sharks.
So I ran across something in The Week this week where they put together lots of little things about, you know, one particular topic all on one particular page. I'll just read one little section. Do sharks like to eat humans?
Yes. A resounding yes.
Despite a murderous reputation enshrined in the public consciousness by the Jaws franchise, sharks actually have little interest in human flesh. This is good to know. Of some 480 shark species, only a handful, notably the great white, the bull, and the tiger, are known to attack people, and when they do, it's generally a case of mistaken identity. In murky waters, there's that word again, murky waters, sharks sometimes confuse humans with their usual prey, particularly seals. When they bite people, sharks generally release them and swim off in search of more satiating targets. Nerve endings on their serrated teeth can differentiate between calorie-rich seal blubber and a skimpier human meal.
I've never heard this.
I haven't either. Sharks don't eat humans. They spit out humans, said Peter Klimley, an animal behaviorist at the University of California at Davis. Humans aren't nutritious enough to be worth the effort. Since the first recorded shark attack in 1580, fewer than 2,800 unprovoked attacks and 498 fatalities have been confirmed throughout the world. That seems incredible to me.
Where was the first shark? Is that what happened to Jamestown?
450 years ago, and there's only been 498 fatalities reported.
Really? 498?
If you take a dip in the ocean, there is just a 1 in 11.5 million chance you'll get bitten by a shark. You're far more likely to be struck dead by lightning. That's at 1 in 700,000. So I feel a little bit better about the fact that sharks don't like to eat people. But I still wouldn't want to get bitten by one and then spat back out.
No.
But did you have any idea about that?
I had no idea. I really want to know where the first shark attack... Because most shark attacks are in the United States. Obviously, there was no United States in...
Well, there's Cape Town, South Africa. There's a lot of sharks in that area of the world. There's the Indian Ocean. A lot of sharks in that area of the world. Not so much in the Pacific. But, yeah, the Atlantic. Lots of shark attacks. I'm glad we're not tasty to them.
I'm glad. And you're rather sinewy, so I'm sure you would be even less likely.
Tough. I'm tough to eat. Yeah.
And Polish.
Yeah, stringy.
Stringy.
Yeah, I'll get spit
stringy.
Out.
Stringy. Like,
now, you, on the other hand.
I know.
Have you heard about this story about the very, very famous silent film director, F.W. Murnau, Frederick W. Murnau?
Sadly, yes.
The skull of the film director, F.W. Murnau, best known for Nosferatu, starring Max Schreck, his 1922 exhibitionist take on Bram Stoker's Dracula, has been stolen from a cemetery outside of Berlin. The skull was stolen from a family grave site in a cemetery in Stahnsdorf, outside Berlin's southwestern border. Murnau was born in Germany in 1888 and is credited as one of the pioneers of the German expressionist cinema. His most famous film is Nosferatu, a 1922 adaptation of, as I said, Bram Stoker's Dracula, for which Stoker's widow sued for copyright infringement. Murnau did, in fact, lose that lawsuit, and all prints of the film were ordered to be destroyed. But bootleg copies survived, so that's why we're able to see that film today, I'm sure you know. The vampire, played by German stage actor Max Schreck, resembled a rat, which was known to carry plague. And the origins of the word Nosferatu are from Stoker's novel, where it is used by the Romanian townsfolk to refer to Count Dracula and presumably other undead. And nearly as important as the Nosferatu is Murnau's film The Last Laugh. Now, you know The Last Laugh.
Yes. Emil Jannings.
Written by Carl Mayer. The film introduced the subjective point of view camera, where the camera sees from the eyes of a character and uses visual style to convey a character's psychological state. And it also anticipated the cinema verite movement in its subject matter. Have you seen this movie?
Several times.
Really? I don't think I've ever seen this movie. I've seen Nosferatu.
Oh, it's an astonishing film. The Last Laugh, Emil Jannings plays a man who's very excited to put on his fancy uniform every morning to march off to his important job. And he walks through the neighborhood with great pride and barrel-chested, smiling at people. And then he arrives at work in his fancy uniform with medallions on it and what do you call the little decoration?
Epaulettes.
Epaulettes on the shoulders. And his job is a washroom attendant at a nightclub. And the movie is so... And it's about his downfall. He loses his job and has to surrender his uniform. And... Oh, the last laugh is that at the end of the movie, he inherits a fortune and is able to, I think he buys the nightclub that he's been fired from. But I believe the movie's 1927?
1924.
And talk about untethering the camera. This is a film that if you knew someone who had never seen a silent movie and the idea of watching a silent movie was ridiculous to them, you could show this film to them and they'd say, you know what, I was wrong. This movie was incredibly entertaining and exciting to watch.
The film used the unchained camera technique, a mix of tracking shots, pans, tilts, and dolly moves, which to that time had not really been employed on a regular basis or in a feature film like this. Yeah. Of the 21 films Murnau directed, 8 have been completely lost, leaving 12 surviving in their entirety. He emigrated to Hollywood in 1926, where he joined the Fox Studios and made 3 films, including Sunrise, Four Devils, and City Girl. Sunrise, subtitled A Song of Two Humans, in 1927, is a movie often cited by film scholars as one of the greatest films of all time. I would agree. Did we see that together?
I think so. I've seen it countless times. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that film.
Released in the Fox Movietone sound on film system with music and sound effects only, Sunrise is not was not a financial success, but received several Oscars at the very first Academy Awards ceremony in 1929. And in winning the Academy Award for Unique and Artistic Production, it shared what is now the Best Picture Award with the movie Wings. It's a lovely film, if you've never seen it. There's a beautifully restored version out there now, I believe. Is there not?
Yes. And this is a film, I don't want to digress too much here. This is a film that I read about when I first became interested in film when I was probably 12 years old. Read about this movie forever, how brilliant it was. It was not a movie you could see. The only place in the late 60s when I was growing up that you could see films were like this, where if you lived in a big city where there's a revival house or a film archive. This just wasn't a film you'd ever see in DeKalb, Illinois. And I think for years there was literally one, if you wanted to show it in 35 millimeter, there was one print in the world that Fox had. And I remember being just out of college, moving to Chicago. I went to, finally this film was showing it at what used to be the Playboy Theater, which is now a Walgreens.
Right.
And I went to see it, and it was in such poor condition. I was shocked and beside myself. So all these years later, Fox miraculously finds much better elements for this film. And they think they're like it's a seventh generation copy. But it's astonishing now to see what this film looks like and the fact that they were able to clean it up. Terrific.
Yeah, the last version I saw was beautiful, spectacular to look at. A week prior to the opening of one of his films called Taboo, Murnau drove up the coast from Los Angeles, California, in a hired Rolls-Royce. The young driver, a 14-year-old Filipino servant, crashed the car against an electric pole. Murnau hit his head and died in the hospital the next day in Santa Barbara before the premiere of his last film. Only 11 people attended the funeral. Among them were Robert J. Flaherty, a former co-filmmaker of his, Emil Jannings, the aforementioned, Greta Garbo, and Fritz Lang, who delivered the eulogy. Garbo also commissioned a death mask of Murnau, which she has kept on her desk during her years in Hollywood. Crazy. But this incident in Germany is just beyond anything that I can imagine. According to German media reports, similar incidents have taken place at the director's burial site in the past, and the cemetery is considering building a wall to protect his grave. A police investigation is underway. The German newspaper BZ reported that investigators had found wax residue in the tomb and could therefore not rule out occult motives for the theft. What the... This is
who desecrates the corpse of someone who died 80 years ago.
And this has been going on for some time. Vandals have broken into the family crypt, and in the 70s, ever since then, cemetery managers have had to check on the coffin and body at regular intervals.
F.W. Murnau?
Yeah, F.W. Murnau. What is so special about that? I mean, was that the rise of vampire movies?
Oh, would it be as tied to Nosferatu? He actually did a movie called Four Devils, which you mentioned, but Four Devils is about, this gets us to our theme in the show, it's about a circus organization, troupe of circus players, trapeze artists.
Yeah. I don't know. This is the craziest thing. Hey, let's do a little cultural update stuff before we get to our guest here. Donnie and Marie are coming to Aurora.
Very excited. When are they coming?
August 12th, 13th, 14th, and 16th.
Could you know her? Can you call her and get us tickets? Do we have an in there?
I don't know her that well.
Well, you and I and Betsy, our producer, who sits quietly on the sidelines, all met her several years ago.
Well, I thought I'd mention that because we might take a little road trip out to Aurora. I think that would be something to see.
That would be thrilling.
Yeah. Well, I have several more cultural update things that I thought we would talk about, but I can't stand it anymore. I'm like a schoolgirl and giddy to get our guest on here. So I'm just going to jump ahead past all of that.
And all right.
Let's get to her.
That sounds fair.
We?
Good.
Well, Silvio Hernandez de Stasi is a second-generation circus performer who grew up touring with various circuses, including Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Perhaps you've heard of those, Roscoe.
Yes.
She also performed at the Circus World Championships in London, England. In 1990, she moved to Chicago and began her career as a circus teacher and choreographer. Sylvia is a co-founder of the Actors Gymnasium and an artistic associate of the Looking Glass Theater Company since 1999. Other theater credits include the Lyric Opera of Chicago, Chicago Children's Theater, Marriott Lincolnshire Theater, and the Steppenwolf Theater, among many others. And she recently won the Three Arts Award for Design. The Three Arts Award advocates for Chicago's women artists, artists of color, and artists with disabilities working in the performing, teaching, and visual arts. And she's been nominated for 5 Joseph Jefferson Awards for her choreography, winning 4 times. And as we've said in the past, the Joseph Jefferson Awards are like the Tonys of Chicago.
And you can't come on this show unless you have a Jeff Award. We just won't talk to you.
And we prefer multiple Jeff Awards.
Yes.
So, Sylvia, welcome to Talk Sports. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You know, Roscoe and I went to see with our producer, Moby Dick, a week ago tonight, and had the most phenomenal time, the most fantastic experience. In fact, Roscoe was part of a audience participation section where one of the sailors actually stomped on his foot during the big harpoon banging scene because we were, again, also sitting in the very front row.
I was going to say, you must have had a good seat.
I had a good seat and I have size 14 feet. So I get walked on every day at some point.
I have to ask you right off, though, before we get to more of Moby Dick, what is it like touring with a professional circus troupe? Because in my head, it's all like the greatest show on earth, the Cecil B. DeMille movie. Is it exactly like, please tell me it's exactly like that.
It's exactly like that.
Really? Wow.
It is nothing like that.
Nothing like that.
We do not stay in our costumes and our makeup all day, every day in between shows. We actually just put it on right before the
Even
show.
The clowns?
Yeah, they take it off. And then they're just normal people.
Wow.
But yeah, it's an adventure living on a train and traveling.
So you do travel by train with all the animals and all of that?
Yeah, we did. With Ringling Brothers, we did live on the train. Most of our career, we just traveled in, you know, RVs and stuff like that. But I love the experience of touring and not having to actually drive. And living on the circus train and just being able to go home and wake up in the next town, it was kind of magical, I have to say.
Clarify for our listeners, what is your particular expertise in the circus arts?
I used to be a flyer for a teeterboard act, which is the top person that flies through the air off the teeterboard, which is a springboard, and lands on 4 of her brother's shoulders or into a chair, which was my specialty, just landing.
You know, Roscoe used to do that.
I did.
You were the top person in the teeterboard.
I was. I'm a man of many talents, none of which we've talked about on the show.
None whatsoever.
Can I ask what the interior, the living quarters were like on the train? I'm fascinated by this.
Well, it depends, you know, where on the food chain you were. If you were lower down, if you were a clown or a showgirl, you would live, sorry, oh my God, I'm going to get in so much trouble.
Not at all.
You would live in what they called a roomette, which is the size of a bed. If you were, you know, maybe one of the traveling stagehands, you would live in a bunk, which was the size of 3 stacked beds.
No.
But I had their staterooms, which are a size of like a, you know, a small teeny tiny RV. You know, with a dinette that turns into your bed and a bunk and a little tiny tiny, tiny kitchen, and then a shared bathroom. In every car would have a bathroom. But then if you were Gunther Gable Williams or if you were some fancy pants, then you'd have a whole train car to yourself.
But where would the stagehands and the roustabouts, where would they go to eat? Was there a meal car?
Yeah, they call it the pie car.
The pie car.
Yeah.
Of course they do.
It's only custard pies, cream-filled pies.
Of course they do. That's fantastic.
And to get to the pie car, you have to travel through almost every car, which is like going through Europe, because you would go through the Romanian car and the Bulgarian car and the American car and the clown car. No, well, it wasn't the clown car, but it was the where all the clowns lived in their little tiny roomettes. And then the showgirl
800
car.
Of them in a tiny little car.
And all that was really fun. And you make your way through, and then you make your way back, and then you stop and, you know, chat with people. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, actually. It sounds like a big family, a big community, for sure. Yeah. It sounds fantastic. It sounds like something I should have run away from home and tried to do for a while, as some kids do.
What I ended up doing was running away from the circus and starting a...
That's exactly right. Now that leads me into my next question, and we'll get into a little bit of the Moby Dick saga here. How did you get involved with David Catlin, the director of this piece, in creating the storytelling and staging of Moby Dick? Was this something you were involved with from the beginning because of your Looking Glass collaborations? Were you involved with the Northwestern Project? How did that come about?
Well, I've worked with Catlin for many years. He has a very physical aesthetic for a lot of his shows. So I've done a lot of productions with him. I did work on the production of Moby Dick at Northwestern. And it's been an amazing journey because I feel like it hasn't even ended yet. It started, we did a workshop production with two other companies.
And that was what, about 3 years ago or something like
that?
It was
a couple of years ago, and it was a work... We each did a half-hour version of our version of Moby Dick, and we had a crew of people would come and watch a half hour, and then they'd all switch so they could see the three different... but they were all totally different. House Theater did one, we did one, and that's where it began.
Now, did you pick things from each of the three versions to kind of use and distill into this one, or did your and David's process kind of just begin to evolve and follow through?
I think there was always something that we loved about each one that we tried to incorporate, but there was a lot of things that we discovered along the way, and they were all really different because the space was pretty small, but it had some great structural things in it, some scaffoldings and stuff like that were already built into the small theater. It was so much smaller. And then at Northwestern, we decided to use ropes and Spanish webs, and then at Looking Glass, we decided to go with poles. It kind of changed a little bit. We kind of did discover things on the way that we loved and stuff that we loved, but we had to leave behind. And it's just, like I said, it's just been a great collaborative journey because each time we've had a different cast, they've brought different specialties to the room. And then we kind of draw on everyone, not just, you know, the designers. I mean, the actors have input, and that's kind of the great thing about working with David Catlin. He's very collaborative, and everybody's throwing in ideas, and we're working off of what we come up with.
What sort of familiarity did you have with Melville and Moby Dick, the novel, prior to getting involved in the project, other than just knowing about Moby Dick?
Well, I knew it was a whale, and I knew everybody died at the end. I did not read the book. And I'm sorry. David Catlin, who wrote and directed Moby Dick, is well-versed in the book and all of its underlining meanings. And he pulls out what is meaningful to him, which is what he did with Looking Glass Alice as well. The stuff that means stuff to him, he puts into his productions, which makes them more heartfelt. And I think that's what makes them successful.
Talk about your inspirations for various aerial sequences in the show. The sailor falling overboard, the sailor falling from the masthead, the fates at various times. What sort of inspiration did you have for those? Or again, was it really a collaborative effort on the part of the designers and the actors and yourself?
Yeah, it was very collaborative. At Northwestern, we had a young man who was very brave and very willing to learn skills and come in out of the ceiling. But he did not have the same skills that Javen had, who is in the production currently, who is more circus-oriented.
Javen Ulenbeyer.
He is a circus professional, and he had different skills to draw on than Matt Moynihan, who played that part at Northwestern, I loved what he did. He did a lot. He came down out of the cats, but all his choreography was done on the floor at like a contact improv stuff that we kept, you know, we pulled pieces from and put it together on the floor. With Javen being, you know, an aerialist, we decided to make it more of an aerial routine. So, and again, we drew on the strengths of the ladies that were the fates that were doing the drowning of him. And, you know, I just love what we all came up with together. I thought it worked really well.
And it's a beautifully complex and athletic aerial ballet that he does with straps assisted by the fates or impeded by the fates. How did this routine develop? Is this something that Javen came up with much on his own because of his prior skills with this? How did this really come about?
Mostly I just asked him to do things and he did them, and and it worked out pretty well. I said, can you hold the two ladies on each arm if we pull you up?
And yeah, that part I couldn't believe.
He said, let me try. And I said, okay. And it didn't work exactly the right way. And then so we kind of tweaked it a little bit. And then he said, well, what if I do this? It, you know, it makes me look like I'm tumbling. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good one. So, again, collaboratively, I would ask him to try something. You know, the problem with having an amazing circus performer is they can do amazing things, but sometimes they don't look right. You know, it's like, that's really cool, but it doesn't look like you're drowning. It doesn't look like the fates are drowning you, which mm-hmm. was a big thing. It's like... One of the things about straps is you have to wrap your arms really specifically. So usually if you watch a strap routine at a circus, you'll see the gentleman doing his own thing because that's the way we do it. But I was like, you cannot wrap your own arm. You cannot adjust it. You know, anything that pulls me out of the story cannot be done. So we had to teach each, you know, the ladies how to do it specifically so that it would never look like he was in control. And that's kind of the challenge with that kind of work, because there's a lot of things you could do. There's like, oh, that's really exciting, but if it pulled you out of the story, then it would be like, oh, what's the point? And you know, it's not the way that we work with that kind of show.
Yeah, to clarify, there were these three women who played various roles, but one of the important things they played were roles called the fates, and they would show up when tragedy or death was about to happen or something, and they would become part of the action around the sailing men and around the ship itself, and they play a very prominent role in this scene where this sailor falls from the masthead rather tragically because he was very much liked up to that point. And they do other things in the show as well. They comment, they're sort of a little bit of a chorus.
They make sound effects. The very beginning when he opens the door of the room where he's staying, you're...
They sing.
They sing.
They sing beautifully. Did you know that? Did you catch that? Because a lot of people don't know that's happening live.
I was sitting in front of one of the whale noise makers, which was attached to the wall. It was a big sort of steel piece.
They call it a...
Is it tin?
It was like a thunder sheet.
That's exactly
it.
It's a thunder sheet,
if you know anything about theater, which I know you don't, Roscoe. attached to the wall, and they would use these little rubber mallets and run the rubber mallet on. How they figured out that can make whale noise,
I don't know. Isn't that crazy?
Can we talk about, I'm fascinated, you know, the set is constructed so that the entire audience feels like you're sitting inside of a whale with the whale ribs coming up. And the largest or the strongest are these pipes at the very front of the stage, on either side of the stage, that the actors often climb up, which astonished me. My arms would snap off if I tried to climb up these. How tall are those
I'd say they're about 20 feet.
But those actors climb up and they get pretty high and perch on very little that's holding them in place. How worried are you that they're going to stay there and not fall or plunge?
You know, it's interesting because as a teacher, I'm always worried when I ask somebody to do something where there's some risk involved. But, you know, we train really hard and we train to a point where those people are hyper aware of the risks that they're taking. It's not like they're, you know, just running up there. It looks like them. That's what they're doing. But what we do is an apparatus called the Chinese pole, which is a straight pole. And then when we talked about using the curved pole, I was like, wow, that could be really cool. Or it could be really hard because we're used to the straight vertical poles. But they lent themselves so well to the Chinese pole acrobatics that Javen already knows. And one of the other boys learned a lot of the stuff because he was very adept and he was really excited to learn. So, you know, we trained at the actor's gym for a few weeks beforehand during workshops and built some strength. And then as we were going through rehearsals, we just, you know, we would have people condition and practice.
Tell us a little bit about some of the other choreography in the show. I actually read an article yesterday in the Chicago Tribune that was unfortunately titled Dancing Queequeg. The nightmare number that Ishmael, played by Jamie Abelson, has when he is forced to bunk with Anthony Fleming, who's playing Queequeg, and understands that Queequeg is a cannibal or has been known to be a cannibal, and he has a long nightmare. That was an amazing piece of choreography. And Anthony Fleming is an amazingly physical and athletic human being. Did you develop that together? Was this something that he kind of came up with and you helped refine?
They came up with most of that on their own. What we did during workshops is said, okay, this is what you're, you know, go work over there, work together, come up with some moves that represent, you know, a nightmare of being eaten by a cannibal. And they were over there working by themselves. And I went over, you know, on the other side, we had actually another piece of choreography, which I'm also really love, is the very end when Ahab gets pulled under by the whale, the rope choreography. So we gave them a piece of rope and said, you know, this is what happens at the end. He gets Hemp alone kills him. Oh, did I ruin it for everybody?
No. There's plenty. There's plenty to be learned. That's not, you haven't given it away.
So the ladies worked on that, and the gentlemen worked on that, and there was people, you know, on the boats, and it was kind of cool if you would have walked into the actor's gym. It was very exciting to, you know, go from little station to station. The dream, the nightmare, those guys worked out pretty much themselves, and they came up with so much great material. And again, we were like, okay, we could have it be 12 minutes, but we're going to need it to be a little bit shorter. So we pulled what we loved about it, and that's where it ended up.
Yeah, it very effective, very awesome, and it revealed so much about character, even though we knew it was a dream sequence. By the time it was over, I knew what kind of relationship Ishmael and Queequeg were going to have for the rest of the time. It was extraordinary. My other most favorite piece of staging is the Goddess of the Sea with big giant red black dress with the stars twinkling on it, or maybe it's navy blue. I couldn't tell.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty darn cool. Did you invent that kind of thing just for this effect?
I believe that Sully. Carolyn Sullivan came up with that dress, I think. I think that was, maybe it was Catlin's idea, David Catlin's idea, but she designed the dress to, you know, that made it work so well.
And you use it twice in the show.
Yeah, because it's amazing, so we had to bring it back.
You know, this woman, the first time, a woman walks out from backstage, one of those entrances, and she's being trailed.
Roughly dressed like Mary Todd Lincoln.
Very much like Mary Todd Lincoln. I thought, what's Mary Todd? And she's got this big, long train that's several people are helping bring out with her, and it's uncertain exactly what's going to happen with this. Some of them are stagehand type people because they just needed a lot of people, and some are a couple of the Fates as well. And she manages to get on the platform center stage, and she's holding also a big piece of fabric, which she then sort of kind of lets go, almost kind of disemboweled by. Other people grab that, and they pull it all to the edges, and suddenly there she is in a giant circle of black or navy blue, dark, dark, deep navy blue with little star-like things in it representing the sea, and they lightly fan and manipulate the various...
It begins
sections.
To undulate, like
they're
the
all
ocean.
Connected to her, and they undulate the ocean, and in it goes sailors, whales, equipment, everything gets swallowed by this sea, and they did it once early in the show, and I thought that was phenomenal, and then they came back and did it again for the very end of the show, where the ship goes down and Queequeg goes down and everybody goes down except Ishmael. Well, he goes down. He's rescued in some fashion, which we won't give away. But I thought that was one of the more effective things, not only in the show, but one of the most effective things I've seen in the theater in a long, long time. Tell us a little bit. You've mentioned the Actors Gym now, and it's the Actors Gymnasium here in lovely Evanston, Illinois. Tell us a little bit about this gymnasium that you founded. And then tell us a little bit about other theater projects that you might be working on at this point.
Well, the Actors Gymnasium was founded in 1995. Larry DeStasi and Tony Adler, who is the critic for The Reader, and a gentleman named Carl Kolasch and I got together, and Tony Adler said, there's a space available, and it seems like a place where Looking Glass could have their Actors Gymnasium that they always talk about, because that's what they were talking about 20 years ago, 25 years ago or whatever, having a place where actors could build physical skills to, you know, enhance their repertoire. And the company has always been very, very physical. So they approached Looking Glass and said, do you want to look into this space? And at the time, Looking Glass was, we don't have the manpower, but you should talk to Sylvia Hernandez. She's a circus girl, and Tony Adler was really excited about it. So Larry DeStasi and Carl and I, we just pulled our money and we started this little school at the Noyce Cultural Arts Center, which used to be a little school. and it's just thrived since then. And we develop our own productions there. We do a winter circus and we do some youth circuses just at our space. And we have expanded to do a professional track training program for performers to become professional circus performers. This is going to be our first year to have this 9-month full-time program.
So, but in fact, I can go to clown school.
You can go to teeterboard school.
I'll go to teeterboard school.
We've been working in association with a multitude of theaters across the country, mostly with Looking Glass. We consider Looking Glass to be our sister company. A lot of the shows are developed there and rehearsed there, and skills that we want to put into shows are, you know, worked there because it's a nice, safe environment.
I was being facetious about clown school, but if I'm going to enroll in a class, so tell me what are the classes called and what exactly do I learn?
Well, right now we have our main classes are generally circus arts, aerial arts. We do offer master workshops in clowning. We have a clown teacher named Dean Evans, who is very popular around town. Stage combat is one of our big sellers as well. We kind of try to find stuff that people are interested in. Like, we're like, oh, you know, people... We used to do these really wacky classes like... drum choreography, which was really fun. Our shows at the Actors Gym, we always put in, you know, drumming and dance. We teach them dance classes and stuff like that.
Trapeze? Do you have a trapeze?
We don't have a flying trapeze, but we do have a trapeze, aerial fabrics, all that stuff. There's all kinds of things going on. My first production of that won a Jeff Award was Baron in the Trees, and that was the second show that I did with Looking Glass. And that was written and directed by Larry DeSassi and Heidi Stillman, and directed by them as well. And that was about a young man that runs away and goes up into the trees and lives his entire life in the trees. So it lent itself really nicely to aerial work. That was one of the first productions in Chicago that was big circus theater combined, and it was, I think, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I think it started a movement.
Wow.
Let's talk about the season next year at Looking Glass coming up. One thing I know they're doing is a production of Treasure Island, directed, conceived by Mary Zimmerman. Are you involved with that project at all?
I am not involved in that production. The concern with doing, I might be crazy, but the concern about doing two boat shows in a row, you don't really want to make them too similar. So a lot of my work, you know, would probably make it a little bit too similar. I have been approached about working on Thaddeus and Slocum, which I'm really excited about. So look for that one, because that one's a vaudevillian, you know, style show about two brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be my next production with Looking Glass, if it all works out.
We will definitely look for that next season. Are you afraid of sharks?
You know, I was just, when I was in Miami, I went snorkeling, and
what a good idea.
I saw a shark. A shark swam right by me. And everybody was like, were you scared? I was like, no, because it was swimming away from me and not towards me.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
And you just punch them in the nose and they go away.
Yeah, you just poke them in the eyes.
Would you have the wherewithal to poke them in the eye if they had hold of your, like, calf?
Okay. He was swimming away from me, and that's all I cared about.
Swimming away is always good.
Swimming away was good.
The back end of a shark is always a good thing to see.
But it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. We did a little piece at the beginning of the show before you came on about sharks, and so I was wondering if you had you share the same fear. I think that there are some healthy fears. I think fear of sharks is rational.
Well, yeah, but you think that there are very likely sharks in Lake Michigan, which is not rational.
I'm pretty sure there are.
You know, it could happen. It's open all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. You know, and a shark could get down the St. Lawrence Seaway, go through Lake Erie, all the way around to Lake Michigan, and show up at the Oak Street Beach.
You know, there's been documentation that saltwater sharks can, in fact, become part freshwater sharks by swimming up estuaries and up bays. Like, they found sharks inside rivers off of Chesapeake Bay. Is that, you know, that's not right.
Why take a chance?
This is the guest I've been waiting to have on. Why take a chance?
This is a rational woman.
I will go down to Lake Michigan and I'll put my, you know, swim trunks on and I'll get ready and I'll go up to mid thigh and that's it. That's it. As I've said before on the show, when my crotch starts getting wet, that's when I back out.
Have you seen the new production of Pippin?
I did. I saw it on Wednesday.
And what did you think?
I thought it was awesome.
Wow. And we're bringing that up because it uses a lot of acrobatics,
yes,
and
it does.
Circus. It's Pippin as taking place as a circus act.
Yes. The new age of circus performers coming out of circus schools around the country, which is what, you know, we're hoping to develop at the Actors Gym with this new program, is not just, you know, when I was in the circus, I flew off the teeter board and I landed on my brother's shoulders and that's all I did. But now they're training performers to be more well-rounded, which was, you know, our desire from the start, to take an actor, give them all these skills. What they're doing now is they're training circus performers that can also sing and dance. So they're now going at it from the other angle. So I just recently spoke to somebody about the cast at Pippin, because sometimes you'll take a circus performer and put them in a show as a circus performer, and that's what they do. But what they did was they found amazing singer-dancers to fill out the chorus and play those lead parts. Like Andrea Martin or Adrienne Barbeau, she was trained, you know, afterwards to do that part, and they both did a fabulous job. I didn't see it on Broadway. My brother worked on it on Broadway for a while.
Was he in it?
No, he was one of the circus trainers.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So
your brother is Tony Hernandez.
Yes, yes. So it's that's what I was talking about. Like, that's what we want to develop at the Actors Gym, is a performer that can go out and perform with Ringling Brothers at Martin and Bailey Circus as a circus performer. But these days, with all the circus schools, you know, putting out all these amazing performers, it's getting really competitive. So you need to have those well-rounded skills. You need to be able to sing. You need to be able to dance. You need to be able to act. And you need to be, you know, and this, if you're a circus performer, you need those tools. You don't necessarily need to have circus skills if you're an actor, but it doesn't hurt.
Now, Cirque du Soleil is about to come into town doing their Curios show.
I'm going to opening night. I'm so excited.
Outside the United Center in the big parking lot there. This is a new show, right? No one's really seen this in Chicago. It's been touring for a bit. So, what's your feeling about Cirque du Soleil? They do a different kind of presentational circus performance. There is, of course, theatricality to it, but they're not necessarily telling a story using circus techniques like a Pippin or like Moby Dick. It's a whole different thing. Have you been familiar with people in Cirque for some time?
I grew up in the circus where, you know, with circus purists. They do it for the thrill of it. There's never any deeper meaning. You fly through the air, you land in a chair, people think it's cool. you know, that's why we used to do it. But now adding theatricality is an important aspect, because people, they're a little bit, some people don't like to watch people take risks. And some people complain about the risks that we take, and why would you watch it? You know, why would Nick Willenda want to walk across the Grand Canyon? You know, and some people like it. And there's something for everyone. And Cirque du Soleil's style of circus is amazing and beautiful, and you may not get the story. There's always some kind of story. A lot of times I walk away and I go, this is what I got from it, and somebody else will be like, oh, this is what I got. And I think that's awesome. I think, you know, not like driving a message home sometimes is kind of great, gives people something to think about. And then there's the thrill factor, and then there's the, you know, heart factor and the emotion factor. And I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do circus. And I happily embrace all of them, which makes me a little bit different. Some people are like, this is the only way to do it, and this is the only way to do it. But I just love it all.
Do you teach stilt walking?
We certainly do.
Oh, my God. Can we talk about that for a second? There is a sequence in Moby Dick where one of the women, and she comes out on stilts.
Yeah. Oh, I know what part you're talking about.
It's the section where they're describing what whales are all about, what kinds of whales there are.
Yes.
And they're,
So it's a woman in this long, you know, dress, period dress of the 1850s, when I guess the novel was written. And she comes out in these... Those stilts, she was so high in the air, and the stilts have they're 2 inches around at the bottom. Mm-hmm. How does that work? I couldn't believe it. I thought she has to be held up by wires.
You know, it's hilarious. Of all the circus apparatuses that we do or we teach at the gym, the stilts are the one things I think I have never, ever done. But it's all the stuff that we do is very interweaved. Like, it's all about core. It's all about strength. It's all about balance. So Casey Foster, who's the one that walks stilts, she's a dancer. She's very, you know, you stand upright, you keep your core tight. And it's a little bit scary, but it's not as hard as you would think. But it's challenging. But, you know, I teach children, and the great thing about teaching children as opposed to adults is they don't think about anything. They're like, strap them on and go. Unicycle, rolling globe. We used a rolling globe in Little Prince last year, and we taught grown-up men to, grown-up people to walk the stilt, rolling globe, which is the same.
What is that? Is that when you walk on a ball?
Big ball, yeah.
Wow.
Which is harder than the stilts.
Does anybody ever walk on stilts on the rolling globe?
No, but
I would pay good money to see that.
I saw a video of a Chinese acrobat who rode a unicycle onto a rolling globe and then rode the rolling globe and the unicycle across to the other ramp and down. I was like, what? That blew my mind.
America truly does have talent.
Yes. No, because she was a Chinese acrobat.
China has talent.
Really has talent.
Now, the Looking Glass space is one that can be configured in virtually innumerable types of ways, in the round, three quarters, two-sided. You can put people upstairs in the balcony. You can have people inside the set. This was chosen as roughly kind of a proscenium show, with the seats all in one side in a tiered bleacher type, well, not bleachers, but in a tiered section. So the audience is all facing the same direction, facing the stage. Have you found different reactions to people based on where they were sitting? I preface this with the fact that we were sitting in the very front row, and we were sitting in the very last two seats, all the way house right, in front of the, as we've talked about, the thunder sheet that made the whale noises. There was a lot of stuff going on over there at times. And I'm not going to say it wasn't interesting, but it didn't have anything to do with the sailing ship or Ahab here and there. And in fact, there were times when there were stagehands with headsets and belt packs on very close to me. And I realize that that's just the nature of what has to happen in order to get something like that done.
You know, and that's actually part of David Catlin's aesthetic. Part of his aesthetic is having to see the inner workings of the actual set. He did the same with Looking Glass Alice. He did the same with Little Prince at Northwestern. He had the stagehands be part of the show. That's just how he likes it. But I would suggest you go see it again and sit in the middle, because it is a different experience. And I just had someone say, where should I pick my seat? And I'm like, there is not a bad seat in that house. But I think maybe you had one.
it didn't bother me. I love being in the very front row, because I don't like to get distracted by heads in front of me or people talking or reading their program, because I'm a little nuts. And if someone reads their program during the show, it makes me crazy. Or if they talk or they have to dig through their purse, I'm in the front row. I didn't see anything with the actors. I was happy as a clam.
I think seeing the whole set is really important. So being a little bit further back and being able to always see the whole entire set and see, because I think there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and I'm not just trying to sell tickets, but there's a lot
you can't
of,
get tickets even yes. if you wanted to.
There's a lot of
it's
stuff.
It's sold
that,
out.
A lot of stuff that goes on
I'm
that
screaming.
You would miss, that you should go back and see again. Like, oh my God, I didn't know that that they were singing at that point, and that is a lot of the times when we're working on a show, David Catlin is always doing live Foley and stuff like that, and I'm like, that is so amazing, and no one knows. He had people singing in the catwalk for one show. I'm like, nobody knows that's singing. Why don't you just tape it? Then he figures out that magic lighting so people know what's going on. Because, he likes people to know where the magic is coming from.
And remember, the stagehand's got a curtain call.
Yes.
I've never seen that in a show ever in the history of
my theater. Another David Catlin thing. He thinks it's, he did it with Looking Glass Alice the same. He has, in Miami, he has the crew popping up, the IATSE crew popping up from the trap at the end and stuff like that. Because David Catlin doesn't let anybody sit back and relax during his shows. Everybody's working, and he wants them to get their appreciation.
Well, Sylvia, it has been an absolute joy and a pleasure to have you here. I couldn't be more delighted to have you as our guest on Talk Sports. Have you enjoyed yourself?
There was nothing I did not enjoy.
All right.
Is that a double negative?
Yeah, but it works.
Okay.
It works. We would love to have you back some point, especially if you when you do your next project, maybe next season at Looking Glass, and you can talk to us again about these kinds of circus-generated activities that are being involved with your productions.
My next show is actually at the Actors Gym. We do a winter circus, and it uses Lindsay Noel Whiting, who is in Looking Glass Alice currently in Miami, plays Alice, will be in it, and it's directed and written by Chris Matthews, who is a house theater actor.
Sure.
So maybe you could come check that out.
We can. What are the dates of that?
We open February, usually around February 14th, but I think it's February 13th, and it's I'm going to announce this. It's our 20th anniversary next year, and I'm going to be in the show, and I'm making a comeback.
Wow.
Wow.
You heard it here first, folks.
And now I really have to, because I made it legit.
I just read one thing about the Actors Gymnasium. It's dedicated to bringing a new physicality to the American theater, encouraging groundbreaking theatrical exploration. The Actors Gymnasium not only teaches circus arts, physical theater, and multidisciplinary performance to children and adults, Roscoe, it also produces original daring works of circus theater, which you've mentioned and which we're going to come to in February. And it serves as a talent resource, providing performance opportunities for our students and for their students and innovative professional event entertainment for a wider audience. At the Actors Gymnasium, people learn to fly. That's kind of your catchphrase.
Yes, it is.
In all of your ads, learn to fly physically, emotionally, and creatively. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful organization, and you do it so very well. You've become rather a cornerstone of Chicago performing arts organizations, and couldn't be more thrilled that you're right here in Evanston, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have met you today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Absolute pleasure. Roscoe?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you again, Sylvia.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was just thrilling. She's a wonderful woman, isn't she?
Yeah, it was great to meet her, and we were so comfortable together, and interesting things to say, and very so accomplished.
I really, seriously, though, I think you ought to explore the professional teeter board industry. It's time to move on to our closing segment, which is traditional for us, called The Kiss of Death. I have something here for a gentleman who passed away this week at the ripe age of 85. This obituary is from the New York Times and was written by Marguerite Fox. Vic Firth. If you build a better drumstick, the world will be a path to your door. That, more than 50 years ago, is precisely what Vic Firth did, in the process becoming almost inadvertently the world's most prolific drumstick manufacturer. Mr. Firth, who died on Sunday at 85, spent more than 40 years as the principal timpanist of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, playing under a roster of distinguished conductors including Leonard Bernstein and Seiji Ozawa. During his tenure as the orchestra's music director, Mr. Ozawa called Mr. Firth, quote, the single greatest percussionist anywhere in the world. Mr. Firth, called debonair, affable, intelligent, and sometimes cheerfully profane, never planned to become a Stradivari of sticks.
I bet she was proud of that.
But by the early 1960s, after having played with the orchestra for a dozen years, he had grown frustrated with the drumsticks on the market, which he realized could not meet the demands of the full symphonic repertoire. Seeking sticks that were fleet, strong, perfectly straight, of even weight in the hands, and able to produce the vast range and color of sounds he desired, from the patter of raindrops to the rattle of bones to the thunder of cannons, he was forced to jury-rig a pair. Working in his garage, he whittled a prototype that had the lightness, versatility, and equilibrium he desired, and engaged a woodturner to fabricate the sticks. Mr. Firth intended them solely for his own use, but his students clamored for them. Soon, other drummers did too, and in 1963, Vic Firth Inc., as the company was originally known, was born. Today, the company, which has headquarters in Boston and a factory in Newport, Maine, turns out some 12 million drumsticks and mallets annually. Its wares have been used by renowned classical, jazz, and rock drummers, among them Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones and Anton Figg of David Letterman's house band. We are selling the drummers bread and butter, Mr. Firth told the Bangor Daily News in 2008. They may think twice before buying a new set of drums, but they always need sticks. Made chiefly of hickory, maple, or birch, Mr. Firth's sticks, which range in price from about $7 to $50, are designed for durability. But though the drumstick may hold up well under Handel and Haydn, he said in the same interview, quote, a man in green pants and purple hair breaks it on the first rim shot. Everett Joseph Firth, known as Vic, was born on June 2nd, 1930, in Winchester, Massachusetts. After trying his hand at a spate of instruments, he settled on percussion. In 1952, at the age of 21, Mr. Firth was invited to audition for the Boston Symphony. Practicing for 14 hours before his audition, he bested 9 other candidates, becoming the orchestra's youngest player by a wide margin. In 1956, he was named the orchestra's principal timpanist, a post he held until his retirement in 2002. For some years, Mr. Firth's company also made highly regarded wooden kitchen implements, including salt shakers, pepper mills, and rolling pins.
Wow.
If Mr. Firth's tenure with the Boston Symphony made him a star in classical music circles, his stick-making life gave him a cachet with the purple-haired set. As a result, he was sometimes asked to sit in with some of the world's foremost rock bands. In the 2002 article in The Globe, Mr. Firth recalled a cameo appearance with the Grateful Dead in Providence, Rhode Island. "I was sitting on the stage, and they asked me to lead off the big drum solo," he said. "I was wearing a coat and tie and told them I'd look like a stuffed shirt, but they persuaded me to take them off, and I did start off the drum solo." Through an audience member, word of Mr. Firth's escapade reached a member of the Boston Symphony's august board of directors. Before long, there were, for the percussionist, repercussions. Mr. Firth's manager called him into his office. "Tell me it isn't true," he said, "that you played with the Grateful Dead." "So I told him that it wasn't true," Mr. Firth told the Globe. "As I headed for the door, he said, 'Did you really do it?' And I said, 'Of course I did.' 'Well, just don't do it again,' he said." Vic Firth, who gave drummers their wands, dies at 85.
Gotta love that Marguerite Fox. She's a superstar to me.
For the percussionist, there were repercussions. She is a superstar.
You can just see her at her typewriter going, "Aha, that'll get him.
I've got it." What was the one we had a couple of weeks ago? Titanic. Well, we always enjoy reading her stuff, and we always enjoy it mostly because she makes the subject she's writing about come to life for us and does it in such a joyful and pleasant way. Always a delight to have that as the end of our show, even though it's some people might think it's a bit morbid, but I think it's celebratory. What do you think, Roscoe?
Wait till they get to be our age. What is the line that the Weavers had in their last concert at Carnegie Hall? He gets out of bed and reads the obits, and if I'm not there, I know I'm not dead, so I drink a good whiskey and go back to bed.
Well, I'm ready for a good whiskey now. This has been one heck of a show. We've been up and down and over and out, and I think we've done a fantastic job. Roscoe, thank you. High five.
High five.
That was a good one.
Very masculine.
Well, cheers, everyone. We'll see you next time
on episode 13
of
Talk Sports.